Welcome to the first general session of the Philanthropy Roundtable annual meeting. And we have the intriguing title of Creating Sanctuary States for Philanthropic Freedom. So in just a few moments, we're going to talk about how the states are weighing in on some issues and what we can be doing as foundation leaders and organizations to assure that private philanthropy remains protected. But first, I want to set the stage for our discussion. And as you know, the roundtable is guided by the principles that, one, philanthropic freedom is essential to a free society. Two, a vibrant private sector generates the wealth that makes philanthropy possible. And three, voluntary private action offers solutions for most of society's, for society's most pressing problems. And all, as you all know, we are very vigilant in supporting donor intent. So if you understand what the Philanthropy Roundtable is and the issues that drive us, then it really illuminates why we are so determined to protect the freedom of both philanthropic organizations and individuals. We want to be sure that individuals and organizations can give their money to the causes they're most passionate about. The Roundtable has a project called the Alliance for Charitable Reform that specifically undertakes these efforts. The Alliance for Charitable Reform is headed up by Sandra Swirsky, our executive director, who's sitting in the back of the room. And we really lead efforts on these issues. We engage in debate, and we take a stand in support of private giving. Now, there are several areas that the Roundtable has identified as red flags for private philanthropy. But basically, they fall into two categories. So the first category is activities that limit the amount of money that might be available for charity or for philanthropic activity, and that then chips away at incentives for giving. For example, we've seen at both the federal and the state level, and I'll talk about the states in a moment, efforts to cap the charitable deduction. We at the Roundtable believe that capping the deduction would ultimately reduce giving and, more importantly, would place greater financial burdens on charities. Now, the second area where we see some troubling challenges is efforts to limit the independence and freedom of private philanthropy. Now, we're seeing advocacy groups and even some elected officials eyeing foundations and their assets. They are seeking to impose their values and their priorities on private organizations. Their attention is often directed at either the composition of the board or the composition of the staff, the operations of a foundation, and not surprisingly, the grant making itself. It's important, I think, to understand how these types of ideas can even take root. The hook that organizations use is the tax status of private foundations. The view is that the tax exemption itself that private foundations receive means that some of their money is public, belongs to the public. The argument goes that the money belongs to the public, and because if not for the tax exemption, the money would be in the public coffers. Therefore, the public, through their elected officials, can tell you who you can employ, who sits on your board, who you should be giving your money to. Now, the reasoning, of course, is absurd, we believe, and we have a monograph that explores that. But I think it's important to understand that this is a premise because some don't think it's absurd, and it's really the foundation upon which we see a lot of these causes rise. So the Alliance for Charitable Reform has really focused for many years on federal issues. Many of you will recall, going back, let's say, 5 years or so, the Pension Protection Act and the assorted proposals that were set forth by Senator Charles Grassley that would have placed significant new requirements and constraints on private foundations. In fact, it was Senator Grassley's initiatives that actually spurred the creation of the Alliance for Charitable Reform. At that time, the Roundtable felt we needed a self-defense lobbying effort, and we started that. And I think had it been up to everyone involved, we would have hoped that Senator Grassley's efforts would go away, and we wouldn't see them again, and we could all move along without the Alliance for Charitable Reform. But in fact, over time, we've only seen growing efforts to place some constraints on private philanthropy. So the Alliance for Charitable Reform remains as important, if not more important now, as we address both specific legislation and growing trends and movements. We're going to look a little bit more at the Washington scene and what's happening at the federal level tomorrow morning at a session called the Congressional Outlook. So today we're going to focus specifically on states where we've had less attention in recent years, but where we're now seeing a growing trend directed at private philanthropy. Now, the Alliance for Charitable Reform and the Roundtable are somewhat unique because we're an organization that looks at all the states and tries to assess where there are emerging trends that could have an impact on private philanthropy. Where we start to see trends, we'll assess whether there's a role that we can play. Perhaps it's just sharing information. Perhaps it's reaching out to organizations in that state, making sure that they're getting involved or that they even care. Or we can and do at times get fully involved. So at the state level, we're seeing, again, emerging issues in both of those two key areas I noted for you. So on the issue of the money that's available for individuals or organizations, we're seeing, just like at the federal level, tremendous constraints on state budgets and tremendous needs for states to find additional revenues to pay for their ongoing operations. And one of those areas is capping the charitable deduction at state level. We're also seeing at local level an emergence of pilots, payment in lieu of taxes. We're seeing municipalities rescinding the tax exemption on certain properties. So there's an emerging movement to limit what's available for the actual charitable activity. Now, on capping the deduction, we saw two very specific examples this past legislative session, state legislative session. In Hawaii, there was legislation passed that capped the charitable deduction. Very fortunately, Governor Linda Lingle vetoed that. And in her statement of why she vetoed it, she acknowledged that a move like that does not hurt the wealthy individuals it was targeted at. It hurts the charities that are receiving the money. It's limiting what the charities are receiving. And we were quite grateful that the governor not only recognized that, but articulated that quite well and quite loudly when she made her statements related to that veto. Unfortunately, we saw a different situation in the state of New York. And in New York, there is a cap placed on the charitable deduction. Now the cap reduces the amount that individuals in the highest income levels can take on their charitable for their charitable giving. In that case, the Alliance for Charitable Reform very actively spoke out. We joined with many large charities in the state of New York, including United Way, Catholic Charities, Red Cross, and others, to oppose that cap. We were concerned, yes, about that particular provision, but we were also very concerned and made clear that we were bothered by the precedent that was going to set, and we think that we'll see moving forward New York moving that income level down. So on the second area that I talked about, the constraints on the independence of private giving, that's, again, the more troubling area as far as Alliance for Charitable Reform is concerned, and that's what we're going to focus on today. And we're going to hear a case scenario from the state of Florida where there was a threat that loomed, and I'll talk to you a little bit more about that threat, and where a band of interested parties came together to push back on that threat. There's also a case scenario in Virginia that I'm going to tell you a little bit about where legislators became very interested in the issue and took it upon themselves to act. We're also going to discuss how to begin to lay positive groundwork with your decision makers, because as we've been talking with many people today, and we talk about this a lot, if you wait for the problem to be at your doorstep, you end up being a few steps behind. You've got to be educating those who are representing you in your state legislature or in your city councils or wherever they might be on the important role that private philanthropy is playing in their state or their district. Before I turn everything over to our great panelists here, I want to remind everyone and set the stage for you with that often told worst case scenario story of California. I knew I'd get a chuckle out of everyone on that one, right? So in California, you're probably all rolling your eyes, right? We had Assembly Bill 624. And you all may recall that there was a group called Greenlining Institute And Green Lining Institute has been around for a long time and had really been focused on banking practices. And in 2005, when the banking industry seemed to be moving along quite smoothly and loans were going out quite smoothly, Green Lining turned its attention to private foundations. And I won't bore you with every single detail, but what happened was Green Lining, beginning in 2005, issued a series of studies looking at foundations and who the foundations were giving their money to. The studies were based on, and have moving forward, always been based on questionnaires that Green Lining sends out, and, you know, whoever sends back their questionnaire, their answers are compiled into these studies. So between 2005 and 2008, they did a series of studies. They brought the results to the attention of a legislator and got a legislative hearing on the content of their studies. And then Assembly Bill 624 was introduced. Now, it was directed at the largest foundations in the states, the 10 largest, and it would have required the foundations to disclose the ethnic and gender diversity of the board and staff and the sexual orientation of the board and staff. Grant-making to minority-led organizations, minority-led is defined as a board and staff of more than 50% of an ethnic minority. Grant-making to organizations that serve minority, low-income, and the LGBT community. And then finally, you would have to report the business contracts you had with minority-owned businesses. Now, we all shake our heads and wonder how could that happen, and that clearly that wasn't going to go anywhere. But as we know, it passed the Assembly. And in ultimately in June 2008, the bill was pulled from consideration, from further consideration. The Alliance for Charitable Reform did get involved with some state organizations as well to push back on that. What's interesting here is it looks like, and for those who would be proponents, that it was an effort at transparency, and we're going to look more at transparency on Saturday, in a session on Saturday morning. And a lot of people who support it would say, well, what's the deal? It's just about you telling us who's sitting on your board and who you're giving your money to and what you're doing. But when you really dove into the motivation behind the bill, you saw that it was intended to get organizations to direct their grant making to certain activities and other organizations. This became quite clear when the 10 largest foundations in the state, who were the targets, announced in December 2008 that they were pledging $30 million to leadership development and capacity building. And Green Lining responded, well, that's a good start, but it's no substitute for legislation. So writing is now on the wall, and this is December 2008. And this is where the state of Florida now comes into play. At this point, Green Lining stated publicly that they were going to look for other states to go to. They were going to look for other areas where they felt that they could move their agenda. And we saw some activity in the state of Pennsylvania. We saw some activity in New York. We subsequently saw some things in Texas. But the big target was Florida. And Green Lining partnered with a like-minded organization called the Florida Minority Community Reinvestment Coalition. And in December 2008, same month as the statement that I just noted, it released a report entitled Philanthropic Investment in the Sunshine State. Now, like the California reports, it targeted the largest foundations. And also like the California report, it based its findings on somewhat incomplete information and some unconventional methodology. So in our minds and in the minds of those who were in the state and had seen what had occurred just a matter of months ago in the state of California, the stage was set. Now, you're going to hear a lot more from both Bob McClure and David Odohowski about what happened here in the state around this issue. But let me just tell you that the results of what these activities that both Bob and David engaged in was the passage of legislation in the spring this year. And the legislation, which is called Senate Bill 998, set forth three very important provisions. And what it said is that a state agency or a local government agency could not demand from a private foundation information about the race, religion, gender, national origin, socioeconomic status, age, ethnicity, disability, marital status, sexual orientation, or political party registration of any employee, officer, director, trustee, member, or owner, or the employees, officers, trustees, directors, members, or owners of any entity that receives money from that organization. I want to note that any organization can voluntarily disclose that information. If they feel that it's important to disclose that, they most certainly can. Any foundation can seek and voluntarily seek that information from their grantees if they decide that that's very important. The second thing that this legislation did was it said that the state agency or local government entity could not demand that a private foundation place on its board any person based on what I call a demographic determinant, race, gender, ethnicity, political affiliation, any of those things. It also prohibited any government from restricting family member participation. We sometimes hear that as a threat that family foundations should have non-family members on their board. This legislation made very clear that a board member, the participation of a board member cannot be prohibited because they were a part of the family. And finally, on the grant-making side, the third element, it said, not surprisingly, that a state or government agency could not demand that a private foundation make a grant based on any of those determinants. So we considered this a wonderful development. This gentleman will tell you a lot more about what transpired there. But I do want to note that at the same time, there was something happening in the state of Virginia where the Speaker of the House and some other interested members became aware of what was going on. They had a conversation with a foundation leader who just was saying, gosh, you know, this thing happened in California. You should be aware of it. And those individual legislators took upon themselves to look at ways that the state of Virginia might be able to protect private philanthropy. I'm going to tell you, through the course of this, I'll give you a little bit more information about that as we go through our panelists. But now I want to turn to our panelists. You have everyone's bios in your materials, so I don't need to say too much about our panelists, but first you're going to hear from Bob McClure, who is president and CEO of James Madison Institute. Many of you are very familiar with JMI. It's a nonpartisan public policy research organization based in Florida. It has members not only in Florida, but across the country and around the world. Now, Bob is going to talk to you about how his organization became interested in these issues, how they were involved in the activities here in Florida, and the role that James Madison, as a think tank, was able to carve out for itself in this dialogue. You're then going to hear from David Odahowski, who's president and CEO and a board member of the Edith Bush Charitable Foundation here in Florida. David is going to discuss why he personally took a public stand on this issue, his outreach to his counterparts, and some of the interesting reactions that he heard in the course of that outlook, and some of his experiences he had along the way. I also want to note that David was the foundation leader who did go up to Tallahassee and was available for members of the legislature if they had any questions on the legislation when it did go through one hearing. I also want to acknowledge that David is an attorney, and David played a very key role in reviewing the legislative language that bill drafters had created to identify any pitfalls, unanticipated consequences, and it was a tremendous help to have that set of eyes looking at the language. And then finally, I'm delighted to welcome an elected official who played a great role in helping us here in the state of Florida. And for those of you from Florida, this gentleman probably needs little or no introduction. Senator John Thrasher is a longtime stalwart figure in the Florida political scene. We're sitting in his district here, District 8. Among his roles, he served 4 years as Speaker of the House in Florida. During his years away from elected office, he was a political consultant with one of Tallahassee's most prominent firms. But he couldn't resist the lure of the campaign trail, and he headed back to elected office and won his Senate seat in 2009. And finally, this past February, was elected leader of the Florida GOP. So Senator Thrasher, who has approached the Capitol from both sides, is going to discuss a little bit with us how we develop these relationships with elected officials, how we make our way through all the noise that is around elected officials every day, and how you make yourself important to that person you've elected to office. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Bob.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you to the Philanthropy Roundtable, to Adam, who I saw a few minutes ago, but I don't see him right now. But I want to thank you all for being here, taking time out of your day. I know you had a lot of different options, but this is a critical issue for for you all in your particular state. It will be at different levels of challenge for you at your particular state. I'd like to share with you our case study. You can take with it from it what you will. And, of course, we'll be here to happy to answer any questions that you may have. I also brought some materials. I did not bring enough for the entire room. So once we finish, if you just want to grab me afterwards, give me a business card or what have you, I'll be happy to get those to you. In 2009, the largest supermarket chain in Florida and one of the largest in the Southeast gave $39 million to the United Way of Florida. From soup kitchens to epilepsy centers to literacy and job training programs, they gave $39 million. But because the United Way of Florida did not fit what was called, quote, a minority-led organization, end quote, this grocery store chain was vilified by the Florida Minority Community Reinvestment Coalition as stingy, racist, and selfish. In our neck of the woods in the Southeast, no doubt many of you are very familiar with New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina and what transpired before, during, and after. When all levels of government failed, at the local level, we remember the pictures of the school buses still in the parking lots, at the state level when no National Guard was called out, and of course, at the federal level, I think the quote was, heck of a job, Brownie, or something like that. We know the government failed the city of New Orleans. But we also know that private philanthropy was in there first, was in there during, and has remained to this day because many of you are involved in that project in New Orleans, Louisiana. They were first in with shelter, food, and water, and long after government had betrayed the city of New Orleans, private philanthropy today is rebuilding the Crescent City. Walmart, dozens and dozens of trucks as Hurricane Katrina approached the Crescent City were sitting idle in Brookhaven, Mississippi. Home Depot had 800 truckloads of materials and supplies and fresh water in Texas on the west side and in Mississippi on the east side. Sheriff Harry Lee from Jefferson Parish, right outside of New Orleans, said, if the federal government had responded the way Walmart responded, we wouldn't be in this mess. The great story of private philanthropy in New Orleans was chronicled and has been chronicled in varying media sources, including the Wall Street Journal, Sports Illustrated, Town and Country Magazine, and of course the numerous social media outlets that we know well. Why was that? It's pretty simple. Private philanthropy is agile and it's disciplined, and it remains focused. So as we begin this conversation, I think there are really two questions I think you need to have to ask yourself. Why does this issue matter? And if it does matter, how do we go about remedying the situation? And I would also counsel you that this issue transcends the entire political spectrum. It's not a right issue. It's not a left issue. It's not a center issue. It transcends the entire political spectrum. So these are the two questions before you, and they matter. Why does it matter? I give you four specific reasons that I want to share with you as to why they matter. The first, not necessarily the foremost, but the first one is, it's an issue of fundamental fairness. Private philanthropy are dollars earned by the sweat of someone's brow. They have played by the rules already in place. They are taxed, essentially, from cradle to grave. And what private philanthropy does on a much larger scale is no different than what we do when we go buy every single red kettle that the Salvation Army has out during the holiday season. What private philanthropy does on a much larger scale is no different than when we have a Boy Scout knock at our front door and we decide whether or not to buy popcorn from him. And it's no different than when the largest supermarket chain in Florida and one of the largest in the Southeast gives $39 million to the United Way. It's donor intent. It's an issue of fundamental fairness, and it's donor intent. Secondly, it's a private property rights issue. Because it is private property, that is private philanthropy, it is far more efficient and it is far more effective with its money. It's very simple. You know this as well as anyone. When someone owns it, they take better care of it. What is inherited, that is money as opposed to earned by the sweat of one's brow, inherited money goes far more quickly from generation to generation. What belongs to no one or to everyone in the form of government programs gets wasted, and we saw that and see that in TARP. It's a private property rights issue. Third, it provides less demand of government services. Again, across the political spectrum, we saw in Hurricane Katrina the role of private philanthropy, but when private philanthropy steps up, there were fewer demands on government services. So whether you are to the right of the center and you believe government should get out of most folks' lives anyway, or whether you are on the left side and you believe that government has a definitive role, the reality is on that side, the dollars at the state level and the dollars at the federal level are not there today. And we don't know when those dollars will be back. Again, it transcends the political spectrum. Fourth, private philanthropy is the most effective, most efficient way to support those in need. All we have to do is look at the TARP funds and how they've been used, how they've been wasted, and how the federal government has been defrauded. From catfish farms in Iowa to money allocated to the District of Columbia to fight forest fires. No lie. Honest to goodness. We have seen the abuse and the fraud that has occurred with the dollars that have been laid out in TARP. Churches, synagogues, the United Way, Salvation Army, private philanthropy does the best job and the most efficient job of taking care of those in need. The second question is, how did we do it here in Florida? And it will vary from state to state. It's important to understand that California, if California is code red for protecting private philanthropy, Florida was not. And so we had an advantage. There will be some varying degrees within your own state as to where you are, but I would counsel you not to wait. Begin to till the soil now, whatever state you're from. Begin to build your coalition today, regardless of what state you're from, so that you won't reach state of California in terms of protecting private philanthropy. As a case study, JMI, the James Madison Institute, in working with these two fine gentlemen whom you will hear from in just a minute, we really focused on kind of a five-step process. The first one was an educational process. You have in your pamphlet that I gave you a policy brief that we wrote at the Institute, and it was distributed statewide to the newspaper outlets, to radio and television outlets, to the use of social media, and do not underestimate that role. It's very important. We provided a policy brief that outlined in simple terms. It was a policy brief that could be read in 10 minutes, and it passed for the uninitiated, for those who don't live and breathe private philanthropy, it passed the fundamental fairness test. You could read this without descending into the minutiae of private philanthropy laws or what have you, and you could read this and understand it and say, this isn't fair. And in fact, that in many ways is what I think got our legislature looking at this issue. So it's a policy brief. We also produced 700 to 900 word op-eds that were distributed across the entire state of Florida, that again outlined in 700 words the fundamental issue, and you have copies of those before you. There was an expose, a favorable expose, of the gentleman who ran the Florida Minority Community Reinvestment Coalition right around Memorial Day. And when that came out, we were alerted to that, and I immediately called the reporter the Tuesday morning after Memorial Day weekend and began a very serious discussion about what that article had said. And I began to correct him on some of the so-called facts that had been put forth. The reporter and numerous reporters that we have dealt with are hungry to know the truth. They want the answers, and they're willing to listen. And they allowed us, in fact, to submit a response, if you will, in the form of an editorial that week to kind of counterman the expose, the fluff story on the man who ran the minority coalition. So it's very important that you focus on the education process, but do it simply without being simplistic. And I think that's important to understand, that you do it simply without being simplistic. Secondly, build a coalition. Coalitions are extremely important, certainly in our state. They're very important. Different people bring different strengths to the battle. Different people have different roles to play, and I would counsel you as you consider people in your state, they're there. They're already there. There are think tanks. There are other private foundations. There are other organizations. They are legislators. They are staffers. They are private citizens who just give on their own, whether it's writing a $100 check or a $1,000 check to their church or synagogue at the end of the year or whatever the case may be. The coalition is there, so I would counsel you to begin thinking about what that might look like. It's very important. In Florida, we had a ready-made coalition in the form of the Florida Philanthropic Network, which was an organization that was very concerned about this issue. We worked with the Philanthropy Roundtable. We worked with corporations that had foundations, two of whom I've already mentioned, Walmart and Home Depot. We didn't work with those, but those are examples of what you will find in your state. The United Way and numerous family private foundations, many of whom are represented here today. The one advice I would give you in the coalition building is this. Give everybody in the coalition a job. Give everybody in the coalition a job. Some have the heart for being out front on the issue and taking the arrows. We had a very large corporation based in Miami, and the CEO of that corporation, whose foundation has given millions of dollars all over the state of Florida, was furious, and he wasn't going to put up with it. And he was willing to take a stand. So when the Florida Minority Coalition sent out screeching emails about how unfair and homophobic and horrible this corporation was because they did not direct dollars to this coalition or that coalition, he was there willing to take the arrows. Not everybody's going to be willing to do that. But there are other roles. There's a networking role. Maybe you know your key legislator in your district. Maybe you know a key staffer. Maybe you can bring other private philanthropies who may be unaware of this issue or not particularly interested into the coalition. But everyone needs to have a job that they're comfortable with. As a think tank, we can't lobby. We don't lobby. But we can certainly educate the heck out of our legislators and their staff. And so we spent a lot of time in one-on-one meetings focused on this issue. Again, keeping it simple without making it simplistic. But it's very important that you build a broad-based coalition and everyone in the coalition has a job that they're comfortable with. Some of the private philanthropies that were a part of the Florida Philanthropic Network didn't want to be seen or heard. They just wanted to write a check. Fair enough. Everyone needs a job. The third component was meet with key legislators and then broaden your outreach. So the Institute started with committee chairs. We started with key staffers at the Senate President level, at the House Speaker level. We started with those folks, key committee chairs, and then once there was interest, once there was sincerity on the part of the legislature that they were really wanted to hear more, we began to broaden our outreach with other key legislators, with the governor's office, whomever it may be. So, start with key legislators and then broaden your outreach. And Senator Thrasher is going to talk to you more about that in just a second. The fourth component for us was you have to hit the media, old and new, old and new media. The James Madison Institute has an extensive social network. We can Facebook and we can Twitter and hit thousands upon thousands of people on this issue like that. You cannot underestimate the role of social media. But the, quote, old, end quote, media also needs to be a part of this issue. The editorial boards that we met with and saw, they got it. They understood the issue of fundamental fairness. And they understood, as Sue referenced a few minutes ago with some of the elected officials, they understood how valuable and important private philanthropy is. when I called the reporter about the fluffy exposé on the gentleman who ran the coalition. The reporter was there listening and allowed us to respond. Those are the kinds of things you need to do. Editorial boards, they will be there, and if you explain it to them, they'll join your side. And then finally, you have to lobby the issue. As I said, the James Madison Institute could not do that, but there were a number of folks within the coalition who were able and willing to hire a lobbyist and allow that man at that time to go forth and lobby it, to shepherd it through. And Senator Thrasher, I know we'll talk more about that. That was not our role. We were the educational organization. So what ended up happening in Florida is that really we didn't have a full fight. We didn't have to fight the battle that is now being fought in California. We didn't have to fight the fight that many of you may have to fight. In Florida, we kind of worked through the issues with the legislature, and before anybody knew it, we had a law in place. But there was a lot of soil that was tilled ahead of time, and there was a lot of work done ahead of time, and literally, I kid you not, by the time a reporter got to the man who runs the Florida Minority Coalition, he had no idea what law had been passed, and he knew nothing about it. Your state's going to vary. It's going to be different. So don't wait. I would counsel you, don't wait until code red in your state to begin this issue. Begin as soon as you can. And I'll close with this. You're going to take some arrows. Winston Churchill has said that courage is the greatest of all character traits because it is the one character trait that enables all others. And he's right. There are certain people in your coalition who will have to take the arrows, but you're going to have to take a step to get the job done. Single greatest example of American exceptionalism, in my view, is the generosity of the American spirit, and it's under assault. Before this panel is finished, there will be two clear divergent paths, California and Florida, both of whom are bellwether states. I'd urge you to choose the latter, not because it's my home state, but because it's the right thing to do. Thank you very much.
It's a tough act to follow Dr. Bob. My involvement was personal, was professional and personal. And it did get personal when, as Bob mentioned, when they went after my favorite grocery store. And I'm sure that you have your favorite grocery store in whatever town that you're in. And Publix is really a great place. I hope that if you get an opportunity, if you're going home or going to the airport, stop in. You get a sandwich. You can pick up some produce. Publix is where shopping is a pleasure. No, I'm not a shareholder because you have to work there to be a shareholder. But that did that made it real personal to me because besides the $39 million that they do, my kids have stood outside of Publix and raised money for their soccer teams and for the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts, and they're really, really terrific people. Professionally, though, it was like I was watching the Weather Channel. I live here in Florida. It's just another day in paradise. I know some of you winter here or you winter in other places that are warm. And come January or February, when you turn on the Weather Channel and you see that reporter and she's standing out in front of Mary Tyler Moore's house in Minneapolis, it's 10 degrees below zero. Well, that's how I felt when greenlining came in. I thought all of Florida would have to freeze over before greenlining came in. And lo and behold, there they were. I need to say that the Florida Philanthropic Network wasn't able to take an official position on this. We were in some leadership transition, and in the network we have various opinions. But even my most liberal friends, my most liberal colleagues said, "Ah, David, don't worry." Don't worry about it. That conservative group up in Tallahassee, it'll never get through. Plus, we were the Jeb Bush was our governor for for two whole terms, and is one of the most endeared politicians in this in the history of the state. Well, we got to work at it, but we got to work at it for all the right reasons. And first off, I want to say that this issue is important for the economic history of the state of Florida and for your state. Foundations don't get created out of thin air. There's an entrepreneur who creates jobs. Jobs create wealth. Wealth creates foundations. Foundations improve the quality of life that attract entrepreneurs. That's what it's all about. And our economic history in this state, it not only includes Publix, but some of the great names in philanthropy: Henry Flagler with the hotels and the railroads, DuPont with chemicals and land, Dr. Phillips, the citrus baron who eventually it became Minute Maid, Bill Tupper with Tupperware. I'm sure you've all dined at a Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Bahama Breeze, Seasons 52. That's Darden Restaurants. There was a real Bill Darden. And George Jenkins, modern-day Wayne Huizenga, Blockbuster, Waste Management, now AutoNation and the Miami Marlins. So, these men and women have carved paradise out of a swamp. We battled mosquitoes, alligators, hurricanes, citrus freezes, and now we got to deal with a group from California telling us what to do here. So it's part of our economic history, donor intent, because if we don't watch out for those donors who have come before us, who's going to look out after the foundations that we're responsible for in the future? I was concerned about greenlining because of the current state of the economy here in Florida. The Edith Bush Charitable Foundation is $70 million. We've invested $92 million in our history across Florida, primarily here in Central Florida. And we took a hit just like you all took a hit in your portfolios. The organizations, the community, and the individuals that we made investments in were hurting. And if a group from California came in and decided that we were to make grants according to their formula, we'd be eroding the equity that we had in these organizations and in our community. The economic future of the state of Florida was really at hand. I'm working with the Florida Chamber and the Florida Chamber Foundation. We're coming up with a strategic plan for this state, 2030. By 2030, we're going to have 5 to 7 more people in this state. We want good-paying jobs, vibrant communities, and we want to welcome entrepreneurs here and make sure that when they work hard, when they take the risks, that when they make the money, they can spend the money. In every one of your communities, large and small, there's a Bill Gates. And you have an entrepreneur who's got some little plastic manufacturing plant. Or you've got someone that was a very successful investor. And shouldn't they, after a certain time, just like Bill Gates, when they decide to focus their attention on the community and enhancing the community that they've been in, shouldn't it be up to them to decide? There's still a great transference of wealth coming in this country. It's coming to a community near you. It's a lot less than it was before, than Paul Shurver said. But just think of anybody who's involved in agriculture, land, building supplies, office supplies, hospitality, tourism. They're going to want to invest in their community. And if they're not able to in California, here in Florida, we welcome you. In fact, it's an economic development tool. If you make a lot of money here in Florida, we're going to guarantee that you can spend your money here. And it doesn't really cost the state anything. There's no cash incentive. There's no land swap. There's no tax forgiveness. It's just an environment that says, We love entrepreneurs. We love what you do, and we want you to, when you're ready, invest not only in Florida, but wherever. Greenlining came in, and you know they want more transparency, and you better be careful what you ask for. It's only recently that here in Florida we've been doing research on philanthropy in Florida. Of course, the Foundation Center does some work. There are some others that do work looking at Florida, but it's only recently that Florida foundations have been commissioning research on Florida. One thing that we found out, lo and behold, on a particular year that we researched, 60% of the grants went outside the state of Florida. I even had good legislators, people that I know, say, well, we'll have to put a stop to that, you know. And quickly explain to them, donor tech, quickly explain to them that if we're, don't we want to allow someone to give money to their alma mater? Don't we want someone to give to help the people in Haiti? Don't we want the London Symphony Orchestra to come to Daytona Beach to change the economy from one from beaches, babes, bikes, and race cars to a cultural, musical offerings. So was involving it was important for the economic history of our state, the current situation, and then the future economy in Florida. And with that, I'll turn it over to the senator.
Well, actually, let me just one brief comment here. Thank you so much, David. I want David to know I'm not going to take offense to his comment about Daytona Beach, where I worked for NASCAR for 9 years, but that's okay.
You love NASCAR.
And the senator has his NASCAR note paper here. We were going to have one other speaker here, and so what I want to do is just provide the bridge between what would have been Senator Jill Holtzman Vogel and Senator Thrasher. Senator Vogel is from Virginia. Unfortunately, she took ill last night, was not able to get on the plane to join us. But the scenario in Virginia was a little different than what we saw in Florida, and I mentioned this in my opening comments. In Virginia, we had a foundation leader who, just in a conversation with some elected officials, including the Speaker of the Virginia House, mentioned that there was this challenge in California, and my, this was very troubling, and that elected official became interested enough in the issue that he wanted to learn more and wanted to find out what he could do to try to shore up things in the state of Virginia so that it wouldn't see the path of California. And through that interest, he gathered around some others interested in this topic, including Senator Vogel, who in her professional life is an attorney who represents nonprofit organizations. So she was very much aware of the challenges facing nonprofit organizations, and she herself took an active stand in helping the Senate and the House. She was on the Senate side, obviously the Speaker on the House side, unanimously passed resolutions that stated Virginia's dedication to private philanthropy, its desire to encourage private philanthropy, and to establish policies and practices that would enhance, encourage, and keep private philanthropy in the state. Moving forward, could we see legislation similar to Florida in Virginia? I don't know. We'll see. The senator may have been able to address that. But I did want you to know that there was this other case scenario that took place earlier this year where we had unanimous support. I will add that the Florida legislature, by the way, passed the legislation unanimously as well. Bob talked about coalitions. I did want to make note that we were very grateful as well to the Southeastern Council on Foundations, who allowed us to at least communicate information about what was going on to some of their members. That was very helpful. Bob talked about the importance of educating people, and it's not just those who are going to be making the decisions, but those who you want to gather around you. And It's always helpful, regardless of the role that an organization is able to play. David, you pointed out that Florida Philanthropic Network couldn't necessarily take an official position, but they were able to help us get word out, by the coalition. Now, we have this Virginia scenario where we had someone who was approached by an elected official, approached by an interested foundation leader, and that may very well be more the scenario in other states out there. But how do you get your message to resonate? Obviously, if you're very good friends with an elected official, that's helpful, but not everybody is. So how, when there's all this noise going on around elected officials, do you get your message out there? Do you continue to engage a relationship? And where do you go from there when things may turn bad? We have invited, of course, Senator John Thrasher to address that. And, Senator, I'm going to turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you very much. Good to be here, and welcome to Senate District 8. This is my district. I often say, if you've looked around here, that even people of means need representation. So I'm glad you're here. I hope you go out in the community. There are obviously great places to eat, and enjoy yourself while you're here. I happen to think Fernandina Beach is one of the most charming places in Florida. Not only in North Florida, but certainly in Florida, and I'm proud that it's in my district. Sue mentioned NASCAR. My district actually goes from right here, at the top of this area, which is almost in Georgia. And some of my Democrat friends think I ought to be in Georgia, probably. But it goes from here all the way down to Daytona Beach and ends up actually at the Speedway. If you've ever been to Daytona and you know where the Speedway is, that's the very end of my district. It hugs most of the coastline, so it's an incredibly wonderful district of great, great people and great Floridians, and we're just delighted that you're here today. When you go last, particularly between two really brilliant and brilliant people who understand what you all are about and much better probably even than I do, you don't have a lot to say. There's not a lot left to say. I just simply tell you this. I appreciate what you do. I really do. And I think most members of the Florida legislature would also, and legislatures wherever you live, would appreciate what you do and the foundations and the kinds of things that you represent. We are in very, very tough economic times. And I don't have to tell you all that. Wherever you live, you've got elections going on in your state. You're hearing the same kinds of concerns that are out there about our economy, about getting things back to the normalcy of wherever that is. And so what you do is important because you, just as Bob said, you protect and take care of some of our most vulnerable citizens. Government has a role in doing that, but we generally screw it up pretty badly. And particularly if you talk about the federal system and what's happening in Washington, D.C., it's driving so much of the concern. I'm not going to get involved in politics. I promise Sue I wouldn't do that. But I am chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, and I am concerned about what's going on in our state. And I just say this about that. We've got an election in 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks, and I couldn't be more excited about where I think the direction of our country's going and where our direction of our state's going. I want to say something about Bob and the James Madison Institute in terms of part of my opportunity to talk to you about, you know, how you go out and talk about these kinds of issues. I told Bob earlier, he probably didn't know this, I have a research file that I keep on my desk of current issues, whether it's taxation, whether it's these kinds of issues, whether it's water issues that affect our state, whatever it is. And I promise you, half of what I have in that file is from the James Madison Institute. If you're not a member of the James Madison Institute, and he didn't ask me to do this, you ought to be, because it is some of the best, well-done, professional research you will ever come across on major, major public policy issues. And Bob is a great leader. David was in Tallahassee during the time we had this bill. You know, Bob mentioned, you know, transparency. I'm all for transparency, but sometimes you don't need it as much as other times. You know what I'm saying? We didn't need it a lot in this bill. We had it kind of fixed and ready to go, and it kind of happened. But what you need more than anything in any kind of issue you deal with, in the, whether it's the Florida legislature or wherever, is you need an advocate. You need somebody who believes in what you believe in, not just somebody who you just happen to meet maybe and try to convince them that you're doing the right thing. You need somebody who passionately believes in the same kind of values that you're out there talking about, that you represent. And when you can get that kind of person as your advocate in a legislative body, it goes a long way. And when you can get somebody who is, and I'm not saying this is me now, I'm not saying this, but when you can get somebody who feels passionately and then is in the leadership of an organization, a legislative organization, then you've got a twofer. You really do have a great opportunity then to get something done. But it's important to build that relationship. And as Sue said, and Bob said, and David said, you just don't start that when the legislature begins. You know, if you got a problem, you know, and you know it's coming on down the road, and this whatever this green lining thing is that what it is? Whatever that is, you got to get out there and start working ahead of time. You know, basically the best time to do it is frankly when the election time is coming. You know, in Florida, we have elections every 2 years. We have term limits in Florida. So we have a constant turnover of folks coming in and out of the Florida legislature that need to understand what your issues are. And you find the right kind of person, you find that kind of advocate who believes in what you're doing, and you start to work with them. And you work with them on the basis of personal relationships, but you also, I think it's important, as Bob said, you've got to have the academic side of an issue. If believe it or not, legislators do read bills. Some of them do. This bill is a lot better than I thought it was. I mean, it was pretty good. But legislators do read bills, and it's important for you to understand the academics of why we're doing this. What's the purpose behind it? You know, and you've got a great selling thing. Bob talked about it. Sue talked about it. David talked about it. You know, what you're talking about is basically freedom. It's the opportunity to do something that frankly government ought not be involved in. And that, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, is resonating not only in this state, but in a lot of states, that government needs to back off of a lot of these kinds of issues and let the private sector do what they do, because they do it much better. So I would say those things. You know, make sure you find the right kind of advocate. Make sure that advocate is educated in the issue, and make sure that they understand the passion that you have for going forward and making sure that something happens. Those are just fundamental things. I mean, it's lobbying 101, but finding somebody early, making sure they understand, making sure that they're really a passionate advocate is so important. Is anybody here from California, by the way? You are? Your governor just endorsed our governor.
Yeah.
Go figure. But having said that, Charlie Crist did sign this bill, which was probably the last thing he'll ever do for me in my life. But we're glad you're here. I can tell by the philosophy of this organization and who you represent that I think a lot of you, and I know Bob said this because he's such a gentleman, that this is not a partisan issue. This is not a right type of thing. It's not a left type of thing. I kind of think it is, though. I kind of think, you know, you believe in limited government. You have a passion for doing what you want to do as individuals and protecting those rights. And to me, those are really important things, not only in this issue, but in so many issues facing our country today. So God bless you for what you do. God bless you for being here. And I hope you'll come back to North Florida often. Thank you. Thank you very much.